Before we begin the episode, I'd like to share the launch of the Nighttime Podcast Patreon campaign. For the unfamiliar, Patreon is a popular crowdfunding platform where creators can obtain funding in the form of a small monthly contribution directly from their patrons in exchange for rewards or additional content, such as the monthly behind-the-scenes episode I'll begin recording in the near future. Although the Nighttime Podcast is being produced entirely as a labor of love and with no interest in profiting, the reasons for the fundraising are threefold. Firstly, there's a need to cover the show's modest web hosting and storage costs. Secondly, in order to grow and expand the show, I'd require the additional funds. For example, a recent story presented itself that would require me to record on location outside of my home studio, which I currently don't have the appropriate equipment to do. Also, during my research for these stories, I often obtain historical news articles and documents, and a more customizable website would be a great way to share these documents with you. And lastly, I'd like to avoid traditional sponsorship as it could be obtrusive and could distract from the show. Successful crowdfunding could avoid that. The donations are small, typically between $1 and $10 per month. If you're interested in looking into it and seeing the additional content that'll be made available, please visit the site. It's Patreon, spelled patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. I'd also like to thank the show's first Patreon supporter, Josh Patterson Morgan, who generously supported the show immediately after I announced it on the Facebook listener discussion group. So thank you for considering helping the show grow and improve. Now let's get to tonight's episode.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, discussing matters best suited to a late night conversation. Mysteries, crime, the paranormal, and film, all under the soft glow of the moon. Welcome. Now, here is your host, Jordan Boneparty.
If you live in Atlantic Canada and are interested in the unexplained or the unusual, you're probably already well acquainted with the topic we'll be discussing tonight. Literally or figuratively, there are few mysteries deeper than Oak Island. The first in a two-part series, tonight's story will be an overview of the 221-year-long treasure hunt on the island that up to this point has bankrupted more companies and people than we have time to name, broken even more spirits, and claimed a total of six lives, all in pursuit of some unknown treasure theorized to be lying deep below its surface. I will say that this is only a brief summary of the incredible history of the island. A full history would likely span several hours. The second part of this series will be released in the coming days and will be comprised of a long-form interview with Oak Island historian and island tour guide, Charles Barkos. You may recognize Charles from the History Channel's hit TV show, The Curse of Oak Island. One of roughly 360 small islands nestled in Mahone Bay, Nova Scotia, Oak Island is a 140-acre tree-covered island that rises at its highest elevation to only 36 feet above sea level. But what it lacks in size, it more than makes up for with an internationally known mystery dating back over 220 years that is quickly turning into Nova Scotia's most famous export, so long as you don't watch hockey. The story of Oak Island starts in 1795 when a teenager named Daniel McGinnis traveled to Oak Island by boat. While on the island, he found an odd depression in the ground under a large oak tree. Being intrigued by the depression, he returned several days later with a group of friends and some equipment to dig, and after digging several feet, they found a layer of stones that seemed laid out purposely. They dug 10 feet further and found a layer of logs, at 20 feet another layer of logs, and at 30 feet, a third layer of logs. At this point, the boys were unable to dig any deeper and decided to suspend any further digging until they were better prepared to do so. Although it wasn't until 8 years later, the boys, now young men, found investors and formed the Onslow Company, solely for the purpose of furthering their search on Oak Island. With the additional funds came better equipment, thus a much bigger hole. The Onslow Company managed to dig what is now known as the Money Pit to a 90-foot depth, with a series of puzzling discoveries made along the way. Following the precedent set in the first 30 feet, a layer of logs were found at 10-foot intervals. But in addition to the logs at these 10-foot intervals, Above the 40-foot layer of logs was a layer of charcoal. Above the 50-foot logs was a layer of packed putty. Above the 60-foot logs, inexplicably, was a layer of tightly packed coconut fibers in Nova Scotia, thousands of kilometers from the nearest coconut tree. But even more puzzling than coconut fibers in Nova Scotia was at the 90-foot layer. Sitting above the 90-foot layer of logs was a rectangular stone with an odd inscription. An inscription whose meaning to this day is still debated, with the most widely accepted theory being 40 feet below, 2 million pounds are buried. Sadly, this stone has been lost to history, having last been seen in 1912. All that remains today is a hand-drawn copy of the inscription with questionable accuracy. When the Onslow Company removed the stone from the 90-foot logs, with a long steel pole, they penetrated the packed earth below the logs and seemed to hit something solid, roughly 10 feet below, which they believed to now be the buried treasure. With it being late in the evening and the sun quickly setting, they decided to suspend the dig until morning light, at which time they would access the solid item below. Upon returning to the money pit the next morning, the group was shocked to see the formerly dry pit filled entirely with water. The popular theory being that the inscribed stone formed a part of an elaborate booby trap, as only upon its removal, water began to seep into the pit. Attempts were made to pump the money pit dry, however no amount of pumping would drain the flooded shaft. The Onslow Company, left with little choice, started a trend that would continue for years and surrendered, ending their search on the island. After 45 years of inactivity, another group, named the Truro Company, began their search. Having the same problem the Onslow Company experienced with flooding, they took to drilling core samples rather than digging large shafts. It was these samples that brought the first real hint of treasure. When the Truro Company's drill sample from the 98-foot depth was examined, it showed an anomalous 4 inches of oak, followed by 22 inches of loose metals, followed by another 8 inches of oak, followed by more loose metals, and lastly 4 more inches of oak. The theory at the time being that their drill passed directly through 2 stacked treasure chests. Another great discovery was made, and a new mystery was born accidentally by the Truro Company when they were attempting to pump the water out of the original money pit. Their attempts were futile and the water level wasn't receding, but it was noticed that water was rushing out of Smith's Cove, a beach on the island. This led to the realization that there was some type of waterway leading from the pit being dug to what is now theorized to be a man-made beach on the island named Smith's Cove. Investigations into this phenomena by the Truro Company found what is now referred to as the finger drains, leading 145 feet from the money pit to Smith's Cove. The finger drains are basically a collection of drainage tunnels that all meet at a central point. Therefore, if you want to stop the flow of water, you must deal with all the individual drains. If the history is accurate, these drains must have been masterfully constructed to still be effective after an uncertain but considerable amount of time since the original engineering work was done. Yet the design was simple. They were nothing more than channels dug in clay, filled with rocks, and covered with coconut fiber to act as a filter, preventing the channel from being filled in, much like the common French drain used today to lead water in a desired direction. To drain the money pit, the obvious strategy for the Truro Company would be to block the individual finger drains, thus allowing them to drain the money pit without it being further flooded. But these efforts were unsuccessful. The Truro Company's last method of attack on the water drainage system was to dig roughly 100 feet inland and hope to find the point that all the finger drains met prior to connecting to the money pit. But again, the island managed to keep it secret. Having both their spirits and their funding exhausted, the Truro Company followed the lead of the Onslow Company and withdrew from the search. The next group to attempt to excavate would fare even worse than the prior two. A new company named the Oak Island Association began excavation on the Money Pit site in 1861 using high-powered pumps. However, upon reaching the 90-foot depth, the bottom of the shaft collapsed into either a natural cavern or some type of void somewhere below the 90-foot markers. It was now theorized that the chests discovered by the Truro Company were likely booby-trapped even further and were now even deeper underground. During the Oak Island Association's failed excavations, an explosion within the boiler of one of the large pumping engines led to the treasure hunt's first fatality, starting a disturbing trend on the site, as well as stoking the flames of a local legend that 7 treasure hunters must die before the island will give up its secret. To date, a total of 6 treasure hunters have met their end while risking it all in pursuit of what may lie below the ground on Oak Island. Only 3 years of starting operation on the site, the Oak Island Association's funds were depleted, and like the prior searchers, were left with no choice but to surrender to the island. Over the next 100 years, a series of different groups and individuals using a variety of different methods and techniques would take turns at cracking the code of Oak Island. These groups included one owned by the legendary actor John Wayne, and a group whose members included American President Franklin Roosevelt. A famous photo even exists showing the president on the island overseeing a dig. During this intermediate period, a fatality did occur when a worker fell into a dug shaft, bringing the death toll now to 2. Although ultimately all of these groups were unsuccessful, some great work was done and some discoveries were made. To name a few of these discoveries, a better understanding of the island's draining system was gained via the first of many dye tests. These dye tests involved pouring red dye into a pit and then, from the air, watching where the red dye exited the island. The results of these tests were shocking as the red dye exited from unexpected areas all around the island, hinting at a much more complicated flooding system than was previously inspected. Also, a triangle made out of placed stones were found, with the point of the triangle pointing directly at the site of the money pit. Also, a drill pulled core samples from great depth at the site of the money pit that included what appeared to be man-made items, including evidence of a cement vault around 160 feet below ground. The drill also pulled a piece of sheepskin parchment with the letters V and I. This piece of parchment plays heavily into the theory that the money pit's treasure may include sacred texts, possibly even lost Shakespearean manuscripts. With this series of unsuccessful treasure hunters and two deaths behind us, we now conclude the early history of the treasure hunt and begin now discussing the characters and events of the modern era of the Oak Island search. After 20-some years of inactivity, American motorcycle daredevil and inventor Robert Restall arrives to the island with both his huge personality and his family in tow, and begins what will be the most tragic story the island has to offer. During an excavation at Smith's Cove, Restall, who was working in the hole, was overcome by some sort of poisonous gas and collapsed into the water at the bottom of the shaft. His son and two workers attempted to rescue him, but were also overcome by the same poisonous fumes, possibly carbon monoxide from a generator that was in the pit. And tragically, all four men drown, bringing the death toll on the island to its current count of 6. Despite the Restall tragedy, there was yet another optimistic treasure hunter ready to take up and raise the ante on the island. The next treasure hunter to throw his name in the hat is the infamous Robert Dunfield. Mr. Dunfield's method was to bring in heavy machinery, the likes of which the island has never been challenged by. To get his equipment, including a 70-foot crane, onto the island, Dunfield built the causeway that still connects the island to the mainland today. Despite significantly raising the bar on the technology used in the search, after only a year of frenzied bulldozing and digging, Dunfield, like all the others before him, will admit defeat and give up the hunt, leaving only a destroyed island in its wake. Some minor discoveries were made during Dunfield's reign, but ultimately, his lasting legacy was destroying what evidence remained from prior digs and distorting the historic lay of the land. The work completed by Dunfield will forever blur the geography of the island and will put a question mark next to the location of many of the historic sites we've mentioned earlier, including even the original money pit. During the time Robert Dunfield was deconstructing the island, across the continent, a 43-year-old Miami-based contractor was reading a copy of the Reader's Digest. And as fate would have it, this edition of the Reader's Digest included a story penned by Nova Scotia-based freelance writer David MacDonald that told the story of Oak Island and the various methods used up until then to crack the riddle. Little did David MacDonald know when he was writing this story that he would inspire perhaps the greatest treasure hunter of our time and forever change the direction of the search on Oak Island. The man reading the story and at the same time forming his plan on how he will solve the riddle is my personal hero, Mr. Dan Blankenship. Almost as soon as he finished the article, the dream was firmly fixed in his mind and he began plans to be the next in line to make his mark on the island. Within the next 2 years, Dan Blankenship and a business partner, David Tobias, formed Triton Alliance Limited and purchased all but a small portion of Oak Island and began their search. During a variety of excavations, Dan Blankenship uncovered many of the artifacts that are displayed today in the Oak Island Museum, including a pair of scissors uncovered below the drainage system on Smith's Cove. These scissors were dated to 300 years old and being Spanish-American origin. Mr. Blankenship's longest-lasting legacy will be his ingenious work on what has come to be known as Borehole 10X. In the summer of 1970, Dan Blankenship was looking for somewhere to focus his search efforts by using a controversial method known as dowsing or divining. Dowsing involves the practice of walking slowly while holding a Y or L-shaped stick called the divining rod and holding it horizontally at about waist level with the rod projecting away from your body. Proponents of this practice believe that when the divining rod passes over underground anomalies such as metals or a void, the rod will react by moving suddenly. This method has been used historically for locating underground water for wells and for oil prospecting. During these dowsing sessions, he identified an area roughly 180 feet from the site of the original money pit. Blankenship had a 6-inch borehole drilled to a depth of 230 feet at the site. While drilling, they found several unusual voids in the earth at significant depths. Also, while reviewing the material removed from the ground while drilling, he found many pieces of loose metal and wires. These metals almost seemed to be oxidizing before their eyes, signaling that they hadn't been exposed to air for many years. A subsequent analysis would date them to pre-1750 and possibly of Swedish origin. Again, where the original treasure hunts didn't start until the early 1800s, anything pre-1795 is considered an original artifact as opposed to something possibly left behind by a past searcher. Blankenship, thinking he found a significant site, now focused his efforts entirely on borehole 10X. His first method of attack was to widen the hole by now drilling and lining the entire thing with concrete to a 27-inch diameter. Next, he lowered a camera down into the borehole, and the results only increased the attention given to the site. The video footage appears to show the 230-foot shaft ending in a hollowed cavern and housing a treasure chest, some tools, and possibly even a dead body. A series of man dives down the 27-inch shaft with the goal of reaching the cavern at the bottom failed for a variety of reasons. The last dive conducted, however, has become the stuff of legend. In 1976, Dan Blankenship himself descended the 27-inch concrete shaft, only to have the shaft collapse on him at a depth of 95 feet. Miraculously, he managed to escape alive, avoiding becoming the seventh to die. Upon being pulled from the partially collapsed shaft by his son David, Dan Blankenship collapsed to the ground and famously said, "You better not say a word about this to your mother." Knowing now the need to widen the hole and increase structural stability, Dan Blankenship, with the help of his son David and a modest crew, famously and ingeniously purchased 3 retired train cars. Blankenship hollowed them out and reinforced the train cars for use as the interior walls of his widened shaft. His method was going to be to widen the 27-inch shaft and lower the train cars vertically into the hole, one on top of the other, allowing the weight of the stacked cars to slide themselves into place, and then bracing and welding the joints together. This widened and reinforced shaft extended now to a depth of 181 feet, at which point the shaft meets bedrock and the original 27-inch shaft extends further down to the 230-foot depth, ending in the cavern at the bottom they'd been trying to reach. Despite the widening and reinforced shaft, attempts to get a diver into the cavern to make a conclusion on what had been down there continued until the 1990s, when exploration stalled due to a series of legal battles between the Triton partners. This dispute wasn't resolved until 2005, when 50% of the shares went up for sale, the portion formerly owned by Blankenship's Triton partner, David Tobias. It was initially hoped that the government of Canada would purchase the shares for their estimated value of $7 million. However, a group of American businessmen in the drilling industry did so instead. These businessmen, known as the Michigan Group, announced shortly after the purchase that they will continue pursuing treasure with Dan Blankenship under the name Oak Island Tours, Inc. After years of legal wrangling with the provincial government, the province would grant the newly formed partnership a treasure trove license in 2011. The partnership and the work they will begin together will dramatically raise the profile of Oak Island onto the international stage, as this Michigan group included brothers Rick and Marty Lagina, who, like Dan Blankenship, were infatuated with the island after reading the 1965 Reader's Digest story describing the history of the treasure hunt. To properly fund the work they would do on the island, Rick and Marty Lagina partnered with the History Channel, who would film the investigation and search being done on the island documentary style. The result of this collaboration is the internationally acclaimed television series The Curse of Oak Island, which is now in its 3rd season. During the 3 seasons of the show, the team has drilled many holes, chased many wild theories, and tied up more than a few loose ends. Many close to the island believe that if the mystery would ever be solved, the current searchers are the one to do it. They're open to any theory, they apply a wide variety of new and cutting-edge technologies, and they're willing to work with and collaborate with anyone who has anything to offer. Which brings us up to the most recent breakthrough on the island. This breakthrough concerns another searcher I've yet to mention, a land surveyor named Fred Nolan. Mr. Nolan came to the island in 1961 purchasing a small plot of land and using his surveying skills to plot the land, looking for man-made formations or any unusual features, his most significant find being his namesake, Nolan's Cross. After mapping the island, he found various large stones laid out around the island that, when viewed from above, formed a Christian cross, roughly 867 feet long and 72 feet wide. Although Fred Nolan and Dan Blankenship worked together for a small period in the 60s, the two became bitter rivals, and although both living together and working towards the same goal on a very small island, they worked separately and didn't share information for the last 50 years. Their relationship has often been compared to the Hatfield-McCoy feud. In the Blankenship-Nolan feud, tempers were said to often boil over, even boiling over to a point that Blankenship approached Nolan aggressively, rifle in hand at one point. Now, getting back to the Laguna's ability to work with anyone, only during the 2015 series of the show, they were able to partially mend the relationship between Fred Nolan and Dan Blankenship, having the two agree to try to share some information and try to work with the goal of assisting the Laguna brothers in solving the island's now over 200-year-old riddle. With this recap of the island's history bringing us now up to the present day, despite a parade of brave, resourceful, and dedicated treasure hunters willing to spend their fortunes and risk their lives, it seems the island's story is far from over. The island has only given up hints of what may be below. I'm of the opinion that regardless of what's found in the darkest depths, the true treasure of Oak Island may be its unique history and the many incredible people who risked it all in pursuit of a dream that seems to defy logic and reason. We're fortunate now to live in a time that Nova Scotia, perhaps even Canada's greatest mystery, is being pursued like it's never been in its 200-plus year history. And given the ratings, it seems that the future of Oak Island will be televised. A companion to this episode will be released in the coming days that will include a long-form interview with Oak Island historian, island tour guide, and the Robin to the current treasure hunter's Batman, Mr. Charles Barkos. I would like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, subscribing to the show on iTunes will grant early access to new episodes. I also invite you to join the listener discussion community at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, if you'd like to help the show grow, please rate and review it on iTunes and consider sponsoring the show at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. I look forward to talking to you again soon.